You know, as I got better and better and was chasing performance, I was noticing that I wasn't that healthy. I was fit and I was fast, but I wasn't that healthy. Intense exercise is a stress. A little bit of stress is good, but a lot of stress piled up day after day is bad. How is it best incorporated into your life? Exercise is truly about the movement. It's about putting the muscles and the joints of your body through different planes and ranges of motion. Move as often, as frequently as you can at low levels of aerobic output. Lift heavy things twice a week and sprint once a week.
Welcome to the Melanie Avalon Biohacking Podcast, where we meet the world's top experts to explore the secrets of health, mindset, longevity, and so much more. Are you ready to take charge of your existence and biohack your life? This show is for you. Please keep in mind, we're not dispensing medical advice and are not responsible for any outcomes you may experience from implementing the tactics lying herein. Are you ready? Let's do this. Welcome back to the Melanie Avalon Biohacking Podcast. Okay, friends, I know I often say that I'm very excited about today's show, but this is Mark Sisson. He's somebody I've been following from the very, very beginning. This was such a surreal moment. He's a legend in the whole paleo world, keto world, endurance, performance world. And of course, I was so thrilled that he just turns out to be the nicest person on the planet. I so thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. It's definitely one of the ones I was pretty nervous about, so I can't wait to hear what you guys think. The show notes for today's episode will be at melanieavalon.com/Mark Sisson. Those show notes will have a full transcript, so definitely check that out. There will be two episode giveaways for this episode. One will be in my Facebook group, IF Biohackers, Intermittent Fasting plus Real Foods plus Life. Comment something you learned or something that resonated with you on the pinned post to enter to win something that I love. And then check out my Instagram, find the Friday announcement post there, and again, comment to enter to win something that I love. If you are enjoying the show, it would mean the absolute world if you could take a brief moment and subscribe in iTunes and or write a brief iTunes review. It helps so much more than most people realize, so thank you so much in advance for that. Hi, friends. Did you know that one of our largest sources of toxic exposure each and every day is through our skincare and makeup? It is so frightening the effects these compounds can have on our health. So we put these products on to help us look better, and yet they actually can be aging us, contributing to health issues, fertility issues, thyroid issues, mood issues, and ready for something potentially even more shocking? A lot of these endocrine disruptors are actually obesogens, meaning they cause your body to gain weight and make it harder to lose weight. That's right, your skincare and makeup may be hindering your weight loss goals. Europe has banned thousands of these compounds, and the US has banned around a dozen. There's even a loophole from the 1960s that allows companies to put whatever they want in their products, and they don't even have to tell you. That's why I am overwhelmingly careful about the skincare and makeup that I use. But here's the thing, it can be hard to find skincare and makeup that is non-toxic and actually works. And then on top of that, that actually has all the products you need. I have found two companies, I am obsessed with their standards and use them every single day of my life and cannot recommend them enough. That's Counter, formerly known as Beauty Counter, and Crunchy. Both of these companies have incredible standards when it comes to what they put in their products. You can truly feel good about using them and they actually work. For Counter products, go to melanieavalon.com/counter. And for Crunchy products, go to crunchy.com. That's crunchy.com/Melanie Avalon. New Crunchy customers can use the coupon code ADVOCATE10 to get 10% off. You'll also receive something special from me after your first order. I also highly recommend joining both of their loyalty programs. It's completely free to join, and with every purchase, you'll earn credit as well as other fun goodies. For all the latest updates, new products, specials, deals, and fun things for me, because yes, I love giving things away, get on my email list. That's at melanieavalon.com/cleanbeauty. You can also get text updates when you text skincare to 877-861-8318. That's skincare to 877-861-8318. So again, to shop with me and get a free gift from me after your first order, go to melanieavalon.com/counter and also crunchy.com/Melanie Avalon. And new customers use the coupon code ADVOCATE10 at Crunchy to get 10% off site-wide. And again, definitely join their free loyalty programs to earn credit on every order. Hey friends, exciting news. My Avalon X Spirulina is back in stock and now at a reduced price. Plus you get free shipping and my coupon code works on top of that sale price. Spirulina is honestly one of the most nutrient dense things that you can put in your body in a whole foods, easy to eat form. It's a blue-green algae, which is a complete vegan protein packed with an incredible array of nutrients. We are talking 100% of your daily hard-to-get vitamin K, 625% of vitamin B12, over 1,000% of vitamin A, 86% of chromium, 27% of vitamin B2, plus so much more, including iron, GLA, the powerful antioxidant superoxide dismutase, and even glutathione. In fact, spirulina is so uniquely nutritious that it was actually studied by NASA to support the astronauts. I searched high and low to find the very best spirulina out there. Ours comes from a wonderful, sustainable, clean, environmentally friendly production facility in Hawaii, not Thailand, Hawaii. And then on top of that, we did our own third-party testing for over 70 pesticides, heavy metals, toxins, all the things. This is the cleanest spirulina out there. And with spirulina, you can simplify your supplement routine and support your nutrition in one easy step. The tablets are super versatile. You can swallow them whole, blend them into smoothies, crush them up, or honestly, just eat them like I do. And again, we were out of stock, but now Avalon X Spirulina is finally back in stock at a reduced price, and my coupon code MelanieAvalon works on top of that too. Plus, you get free shipping. Just go to avalonx.us/spirulina and use the coupon code MelanieAvalon to get 10% off our new reduced price plus free shipping. That's avalonx.us/spirulina with the coupon code MelanieAvalon. All right, without further ado, please enjoy this wonderful conversation with Mark Sisson. Hi, friends. Welcome back to the show. I am so incredibly excited about the conversation that I am about to have. When it comes to this show, I get to interview a lot of really incredible guests, but this is about as excited as I get for a guest. So that is saying a lot. I am here with, honestly, a legend in the whole, I was going to say paleo, primal, holistic health world. Mark Sisson, okay, I'm going to just backtrack and tell my story a little bit. So about 10 years ago, I adopted a Whole Foods paleo type diet. And one of the very first resources that I really dived into was the work of Mark Sisson. He has an online website that is just full of so much information. I would read all the blog posts, all the comments. I learned so much. Since then, I have read every single book as they released. He's a multiple New York Times bestseller. And I've become good friends with people who know him well. So Elle Russ has been on the show multiple times. She's a great friend. And Brad Kearns as well, who is his co-author. But never have I met the man himself. So this is just really an amazing moment. And there are so many directions that we could take this in. So I'm just really excited to see where it's going to go. So Mark, thank you so much for being here.
Hey, it's my pleasure to be here, Melanie. Looking forward to the discussion.
So I lived in LA for about 10 years. And during that time, I had what I call the dark time, which was like a year or two where I was struggling with a lot of health issues. And I really didn't go out much. I really just kind of camped out in my apartment, working on podcasting and things like that. But I went twice to your previous restaurant endeavor. I went to Primal Kitchen once and it was fabulous by myself. Cause again, I wasn't really like going out much. And then I went a second time and it was closed. I didn't know that it was going to be closed, which is actually a topic maybe we can get into later because I'm really, really curious about your life and your life as an entrepreneur and what you've learned in that journey. But so to start things off, my audience is probably very, very familiar with you, but I'm really curious. I was reading your recent books and you do talk a lot about your life when you were an athlete and the trials for the Olympics and Ironmans and all that stuff. You talk about how you actually didn't really have fun doing any of that. And so I was wondering, so that part of your life, how long was it? Why were you doing it? Like, what was your intrinsic motivation? And what was the epiphany that you had, if there was a single epiphany, that made you so radically change your life and go on the new trajectory that you're on now?
Well, I didn't know this was going to be a psychotherapy session. So What made me want to engage in so much pain for so long? So, you know, it kind of goes back to my childhood. I was born in Booth Bay Harbor, Maine. It's a fishing village, a small fishing village. My father was an artist, not a fisherman, but he was a painter and an artist and supported the family actually selling his paintings. I went to school there, was raised there, and was kind of a small kid, scrawny kid, wasn't big enough to play basketball or football or baseball or hockey or any of the sort of local popular sports. I lived about 2 miles from school, and I just found it was much more convenient to jog to school than to take the bus. I could actually get there and get home after school faster than if I took the bus. So I started just out of necessity as a mode of transportation, running and jogging in my early teen years. As I got older, I went out for the track team in high school, and I'd been sort of bullied as a kid for no other reason than when you grow up in a small fishing village, there's not a lot of activity for anyone to do except, you know, be territorial and all of that. So I had a bit of a experience being bullied physically. And so when I went out for the track team and found that I was winning the mile and the 2 mile in pretty much every event that every meet that we went to, the next thing I know, I'm the high point man on the track team and as a freshman in high school. So that gave me enough street cred that I thought, well, I can pursue this running idea. And I did so all through high school, all through college, and then for much of my early athletic career. I had read early on, I was interested in health, and I'd read Ken Cooper's book on aerobics. That was a time at which the beginning of the aerobics era. And the message that he was delivering was that the more aerobic activity you did, the better it was for your heart, the better something was for your heart, the longer you would live and the healthier you would be. And so I embraced that notion and I put in a lot of miles. And in the pursuit of those miles, I wound up having to consume a lot of carbohydrates because that was the standard operating procedure of any athlete. In order to fuel all those miles, we thought you had to carbo load pretty much every day. So my life was about packing in loads of carbohydrate every day and putting in lots of miles every day from the age of 15 until the age of probably 30, pretty aggressively. As I got better and better at competition and I got faster, that was a motivation to continue doing what I was doing. I was one of the best in the state, and then I was one of the best in the region, and then eventually I was one of the best in the country at what I was doing. So there's a lot of motivation behind that. There's a lot of impetus behind that, especially for someone who had been bullied and who had been sort of, my self-image was that of a scrawny, non-athletic person who was trying to carve out a space in an otherwise athletic He-Man world. So that was kind of the impetus. That's the psychotherapy portion of the talk today. But what happened was, you know, as I got better and better and it was chasing performance, I was noticing that I wasn't that healthy. I was fit and I was fast, but I wasn't that healthy. I had irritable bowel syndrome. I had arthritis in my feet. I had tendonitis in my hips. I had upper respiratory tract infections several times a year. I always had a cold of some kind or a flu. So my immune system was shot. I had gastroesophageal reflux. I had a host of things. I had bad acne as a kid, all of which I sort of assumed went with a high stress lifestyle of being an endurance athlete. It wasn't until later that I found out that my diet was largely the cause of all of this. But while I was doing it, I was trying to do the right thing. I was trying to read all the books on how to fuel for the miles and how to eat appropriately. And again, this was still back in the day when the notion of a high complex carbohydrate based diet was deemed the best possible diet. So a lot of what I was eating was grain based. Breads and pancakes and pasta and cereal and any other way I could cram carbs down my throat. As I got more and more inflamed from this diet and ultimately after I had to retire due to injuries, as I sort of realized, I had an aha moment, first of all, that my diet had been pretty antithetical to health and ultimately antithetical to performance, that the miles I was putting in were probably way more than my body was ready, willing, and able to handle. But I think most importantly, the real aha moment came when I realized that all I was doing every day in the training was managing discomfort. You know, when you play a game involves some, and the, just the word play involves some amount of joy and sense of satisfaction beyond a feeling of self-satisfaction for having, you know, run a fast time. Games, even if you're a championship level soccer team or soccer or football team or basketball team, the players are having fun, even under the highest amounts of pressure. They're having fun. It's really, they're working hard, but they're having fun while they're doing it. In an endurance contest, and particularly long distance like marathons and triathlons, which I eventually became a triathlete, what you're doing is you're just managing discomfort. What you're doing is you're pushing your body to a point at which it's very uncomfortable. And hopefully with the training, you adapt to that level of discomfort such that you can push even harder the next time. But you're always pushing up against a wall of discomfort. If it's too comfortable, you won't be racing well. You won't be performing well. You'll be, you know, jogging instead of running. You'll be easy cycling instead of is all out cycling. So the idea that I wasn't having fun, that looking back on a career where it was about managing discomfort every single workout, every single race, and it was only after it was over that I could sit back and go, okay, I feel good now. It's almost like, you know, you hit your head with a hammer and it's horrible, but it feels good when you stop, right? So now when you talk about racing at the elite level, it becomes even more interesting in that everybody who shows up at the starting line that day, at least the top 20 competitors, they're all probably equally genetically gifted. They're probably all equally trained, and they probably all want it enough. And the winner that day really comes down to who is willing to dig such a deep hole for himself and drag everyone into it that he or she wins the race literally by attrition, because people drop off the back and can't keep up. He's inviting them to share his discomfort or her discomfort. And so it's a, you know, it's a pain festival, really. And it's like, again, when I had this aha moment years after I retired, I'm like, what was I thinking? Jesus. I mean, that's such a pursuit. If you're talking about enjoying your life, that's a tough one to argue on behalf of, right? So there you have it. That's my assessment of my time as an endurance athlete.
Okay, I have some follow-up questions from that. One, so you're mentioning this concept of play. Was play something that hunter-gatherers would do? So it sounds like with endurance sports, that's something that from an evolutionary perspective, we would have never engaged in as a thing.
No, 100% right. No, it would be such a waste of energy, precious, you know, human energy to think about training with a mindset of going to the well every day or 5 days a week. So to answer your first question, yes, our ancestors and our, you know, ape predecessors, play is a huge factor in development and growth. And humans are wired to play throughout their entire life, not just as children. I mean, we hear this sort of mantra in child development about kids are, you're supposed to let them play and experiment and fall down and, you know, and they develop social skills in addition to physical skills. Certainly it wires the brain for planning. And as an ancestral human being, that includes planning how to hunt an animal that you're going to eat. So a lot of our ancestors, we hear these stories about the hunters tracking and running after the beast for, you know, 2 hours before they kill it. Well, it's not all running. Some of it's walking, some of it's hiding and crouching, some of it is, you know, skipping from one hiding stone to the next. It's not a linear, all-out run at max capacity for 2 hours. It was sort of a game in and of itself. The hunt became a game as much as anything else. A lot of the early, you know, tribal events were based around games that men and women and children would play, all of which helped with social skills, with learning, with development, with enjoyment of life, with, you know, breaking the monotony of an otherwise tedious existence, et cetera, et cetera. So yes, play is an integral part of humans. And it's the reason that it's one of the 10 primal blueprint laws, that I want everybody to play as often and as much as they can. Back to my own experience, I realized that throughout much of my endurance career, I wasn't playing much. I couldn't really take a chance on playing a pickup basketball game or even a pickup baseball game for fear of pulling a hamstring or twisting an ankle. I couldn't ski for the same reasons. So there was not a lot of play in my life for that 15-year period.
Well, I really love hearing this because I am a self-identified like type A workaholic who feels guilty a little bit about playing. So if I can reframe it as something beneficial for my health and longevity, that's a win all around. This touches on something else that you talk about, and I'm not going to remember from which book everything was because I've, like I said, read all your books, but you talk about the physical activity of like of modern day hunter gatherers, like the Hadza, and how it's actually, don't they burn a similar energy expenditure to office workers?
Yeah, it's not like it's a big deal. There's this assumption that the Hadza and as well as a number of athletic pursuits at the highest elite level burn some inordinate amount of calories every day. I mean, Michael Phelps famously consuming 11,000 calories of food a day. He wasn't burning close to that. I mean, even if you trained 5 hours a day, which you couldn't do every day, but if you could, you wouldn't do it at 1,000 calories an hour. You would do it at 600 or 800 calories an hour. And even that's a 3,000 calorie expenditure. So your body would probably just say at the end of the day, all right, there's no time to do anything else. I'm just going to sleep or rest, which is what these top athletes do. So it's interesting to find out that the caloric energy expenditure from one pursuit in life across the board to another, from ancestral living in the elements to office work to being a competitive athlete, there's not a tremendous variation in calories burned. Now, it might be on a daily basis. There might be some variations. But if you add up the weekly average output, or the output for an entire week, and then divide that by 7 days, you'll come up with a number that's not that disparate from one group to the next. So one of the take-home messages there, which has been, I think, highly talked about in the last 5 or 10 years in our circles, is you can't exercise away a bad diet. You can't it's not a good idea to try to lose weight by exercising, The Biggest Loser and Jillian Michaels notwithstanding. It doesn't work. And if it does work in the short term, it's certainly not sustainable. So we're back to, so what does exercise look like and how is it best incorporated into your life? Well, if you get the fact that exercise needn't be a rigorous form of weight loss or calorie burning, that in fact, exercise is truly about the movement. It's about putting the muscles and the joints of your body through different planes and ranges of motion over time. If you understand that concept, then you get to say, all right, so some of the things that I used to think were frivolous, like playing, like chasing after my dog with a Frisbee, or playing pickup basketball in the driveway with my kids, that all counts. That's not just play. It's actually movement that is fulfilling the requirements of your body to move through different planes and ranges of motion throughout the day.
Hey, friends, I'm about to tell you how to get 10% off the ideal coffee when it comes to supporting your health. So if you guys know me, you know I am obsessed with optimizing basically everything I consume, and that especially relates to coffee. Did you know that coffee is one of the most powerful sources of antioxidants in the modern diet? And yet, not all coffee is created equal. Between sourcing, farming practices, roasting, and contaminants, there can be a huge difference in the health impact of the coffee that you drink. That is exactly why I created Glow Coffee. Glow Coffee is a premium, specialty-grade Arabica coffee sourced from sustainable women-led farms in Colombia. It's organically grown, and we third-party test it meticulously, like every single lot, for purity. And what makes Glow especially exciting from a biohacking perspective is that we specifically made it to be rich in chlorogenic acid, or CGA. That's one of coffee's primary, most potent antioxidant compounds that has been studied for its role in metabolic health, inflammation, oxidative stress, and so much more. The elevation levels of the beans, how they're grown, and how they're roasted all affect CGA levels. So we searched high and low to find the perfect beans naturally high in CGA, and tested them to confirm that, and then we roast those beans to preserve the CGA content, and then test after that as well. Coffee is already one of the potentially biggest contributors of antioxidants in the human diet, so I designed Glow Coffee to maximize those benefits while keeping it incredibly clean and high quality. And this coffee is so clean. It's grown organically, of course, but then we go even farther than that. We third-party test the beans for almost 100 toxic compounds, including pesticides, heavy metals, and mold. Oh, and perhaps the best part is it is absolutely delicious. We're talking smooth, low bitterness. It's honestly the exact coffee I personally want to drink every single day of my life. It's so bright, smooth, and delicious that it's also perfect black for fasting. No added sweeteners or cream needed. You can also splash it on your face for an antioxidant-rich toner. I do that every single day. After the sauna, after the shower, all the things. I created Glow Coffee because it's really about upgrading one of our most common daily habits into something that truly supports your health and performance. You can get 10% off with the coupon code MelanieAvalon at glowcoffeeco.com. That's 10% off Glow Coffee with the coupon code MelanieAvalon at glowcoffeeco.com. Are you ready to glow inside and out? Fuel your day, illuminate your way. That's glowcoffeeco.com. And how intuitive is that? So for example, something I've been doing for years is I actually typically wear wrist weights and sometimes ankle weights just during the day, even when I'm like running groceries and stuff, because I figure then I'm just maximizing the way I would naturally be using my muscles, but I'm making it more difficult for them. But I don't really do, because you have so many examples of functional movement and also like regimented exercises and such in your books to do. So how important is it to actually have a sort of workout routine versus just moving and lifting things and being more intuitive?
So starting about 15 years ago, I came up with this basic template, this basic workout strategy, which was move as often as frequently as you can at low levels of aerobic output, lift heavy things twice a week, and sprint once a week. And so that template is like, I would say, the basic routine for an optimized fitness slash health program, because you want to understand that at some level, the fitter you get, the more you can compromise your health. And I was an example of that as a marathoner. I was very fit, but I was very unhealthy. So with this template of move around a lot at a low level of activity, that encompasses the play, that could encompass lots of walking breaks or easy cycling or any number of other activities, yoga, tai chi, you know, just basic stretching, all of this counts. The lift heavy things twice a week is basically, I would say, the minimum amount necessary to build and or maintain muscle mass. And we can talk about the importance of muscle mass, especially as we get older, and the intention of warding off the vagaries of sarcopenia, which is what most older people suffer from. It's a loss of muscle. So you want to maintain muscle mass or build muscle mass, and then sprint once a week. And sprinting doesn't have to be running sprinting. It can be any sort of all-out high-level activity. It could be on the elliptical. It could be on the bike. It could be swimming. It could be, certainly could be running in the grass. I've got a new machine that I love tremendously at my gym here. It's a rope pull machine. And so I do, you know, four sets of all-out 60-second pulls on that once a week. But it's the concept. Again, if we look at the clues that we get from evolution and our ancestors, yeah, they moved all the time. So they were always moving around and walking and migrating and squatting and standing and sitting and doing all sorts of different physical activities. You know, the concept of a sofa didn't exist, right? So, and they were carrying things. And then they would, and then this lifting heavy things, you know, once in a while they would lift a heavy carcass and bring it, you know, 100-pound piece of leg from an animal 10 miles back to camp. So lifting heavy things twice a week was part of the strategy. And then I like to think that our ancestors were always sort of on the edge of danger and that they might have had to run really fast, all out once a week, right? And sprint really hard. And if it wasn't running away from something that was going to eat you, maybe it was running towards something that you were going to eat. And these they're, you know, I sort of idyllic, iconic, you know, it's who knows what our ancestral life was actually like on a day-to-day basis. But we can pull from modern-day hunter-gatherers that with those sorts of tenets, move around a lot as often as you can, change positions as often as you can. So sit, stand, kneel, stretch, have a stand-up desk, but don't stand at the desk all day, et cetera, et cetera. Lift heavy things twice a week, which for a lot of people means go to the gym and do your workout. And then sprint once a week, which I just described. Those are what I would say the basic elements for an optimized health span. And you'd be pretty darn fit if you really, if you went after those aggressively. Now, can you do more? Absolutely. I do more, right? I do a fair amount more than that. But I also know that if I do too much more, I'm at the effect of it. I get burned out. I literally get burned out because understand that intense exercise is a stressor. And while a little bit of stress is good, and we can talk about hormesis if you want, but a little bit of stress is good, but a lot of stress piled up day after day is bad. So it's finding this balance.
Yeah, you talked about something in your book that I did not realize, but that intense exercise actually causes DNA to leak into our bloodstream, I believe, and then our immune system can react to it, kind of like bacteria. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's a simplified explanation. But yeah, it's like anything that in my days of hard training, I ran my heart up to max probably 4 times a week. And I don't mean just for a few seconds or minutes at a time. I mean sometimes for 30 or 40 minutes at a time. I was in that red zone that they talk about now in all of the sort of cardio endurance training manuals. Like, don't be in this zone, you know, more than X number of minutes per week. Well, I was in it, you know, sometimes 4 or 5 times a week. That sort of stress, it literally tears your muscles down, it's an undue stress on your heart. I mean, I pay for it now. I have an enlarged left ventricle, which but don't feel bad for me because every runner that ran as much as I did over the years that I did, and it's millions of people, have the same issue. This is why AFib is such a big epidemic almost among former runners aged 55 to say 75. We assumed at the time, the more you did, the better. And the harder and faster you ran, the better it was for your longevity. And it turns out that was just way too much, you know, destruction, too much damage, too much trauma on the body. And yeah, some of us were able to survive literally the training and then race well, but many of us are paying a price for having gone that hard for that long. Now you can say, well, the best in the world, if you're the best in the world at what you're doing, then you're willing to pay the price, right? But if you're not competitive, then I would ask, okay, what's the carrot at the end of that stick for you? Why are you pushing yourself so hard? And I see a lot of what I would call age group athletes who push themselves way too hard, and especially for their genetic, you know, predisposition and background. You look at some people, you're like, you know, you are running 6 marathons a year, and no offense, but you're not running them very fast. Why are you even, you know, like, why don't you find another sport? I don't mean to be critical about that, but, you know, marathons are not fun. You can say that you enjoy the challenge and you run with friends, but they're not fun, and you are managing pain and you are creating a disruption in your body and your metabolism, and you're going to pay a price. So the question really is, what is the end game here for you as an endurance athlete or as a weightlifter who's trying to, you know, win your age group, or as a CrossFit athlete who's trying to, you know, compete in the games? You know, there's a fair amount of damage that one can do to oneself that may not look like much in the short term, but in the long term, you know, can manifest as like, shit, I wish I hadn't done that, you know, back in the day.
I have a really big foundational question, but before that, 2 quick questions about the heart zone. 1, do you know what heart zone is achieved from sauna use?
So it's no, because it's an artificial, you know, it's not really creating any sort of an aerobic benefit. It's your body trying to dissipate heat. So I would not use sauna, like I would not use my heart rate in the sauna as contributing to any sort of a training benefit. It's more of a hormetic experience. It's, you know, there are hormesis, there are hormetic benefits from sauna, heat shock protein and stuff like that. But as a training element, I would discount sauna entirely.
Question two, you talked about the red zone, but is there the black zone, like the black hole zone with fat burning and becoming glycolytic versus fat burning?
Yeah. So that's one of the great revelations that Brad and I had years ago and was supported by the science and this friend of ours, Phil Maffetone, who really pioneered the concept, was that many athletes run or cycle or perform way too many miles at too high a heart rate and not enough miles at a very high heart rate. And then, they might run in this one zone that is neither aerobic or truly anaerobic. It's like, it's what we call a no man's land or the black hole of training. And they do it because that's probably where they race. That's probably the heart rate at which they race. But if you do it every day, you don't build the component parts to get better. So, you know, racing, and again, managing this discomfort involves becoming really good. First of all, you have to develop muscle strength. You have to develop what we call capillary perfusion. You have to encourage your body to produce more capillaries to supply blood to muscle fibers. You have to increase the number of mitochondria in your muscles, and you can double it under certain circumstances. Black hole training doesn't even come close to doubling it. You can even improve the efficiency of some of the mitochondria you already have, because mitochondria has its own DNA. So black hole training in the black hole would be like training most of the time at 80 to 92% of your max heart rate. And that's what I spent much of my career doing. What it does is it certainly gives you the mental fortitude to practice hurting, but it doesn't look at the component parts of training, which would say, okay, let's take some time and just build an aerobic base. And while we're building the aerobic base, let's focus on the aerobic base. Let's focus on becoming really efficient at burning fat so that we can extract more and more energy from fat and depend less and less on energy coming from stored muscle glycogen. And to do that, we do a lot of training at a number that we've sort of derived from lab tests that is, for the most part, it's 180 minus your age, and do not exceed that number for most of your miles. Well, 180 minus your age, if you're a 40-year-old guy and you go, wait, 140 beats a minute, that's the most I can train at. Jesus, I can't even go that fast doing that. That's like 13-minute miles for me, and I can run 7-minute miles. Well, true, but what that means is if you can only run 13-minute miles at 180 minus your age, at 180 minus 40 your age, at a max of 140 beats a minute, what it means is you're not good at burning fat. The idea is to get 95% of your energy from fat, which is an aerobic function entirely, does not depend on the glycogen. So we create this strategy where as you spend more and more time training at a heart rate of 140 or less, in this case, the 13-minute miles become 12-minute miles, and the 12-minute miles become 11s, and the 11s become 10s, and the next thing you know it, you're running 8 and a half minute miles at that same 140 beats a minute. So you become more efficient at burning fat. So now when you get in a race and you want to race at 165 or 170 beats a minute, most, you know, a much greater proportion of your energy is coming from fat, and much less of it as a proportion is coming from glycogen, which means you race faster, and the guy that you're racing against or the gal that you're racing against who is right across from you is probably burning a lot more glycogen than you are and is going to hit the wall sooner than you will. So you're training the aerobic part of that very specifically to focus on capillary perfusion, on mitochondrial biogenesis, creating more mitochondria, accessing stored fat more readily and quickly, and eventually learning how your brain can thrive on the ketones that come from burning fat and not depend on liver glycogen. So that's like part one of an endurance strategy that would say build an aerobic base first. And to do that, you're going to have to throw your ego out the window and be okay jogging 12-minute miles for a while or riding your bike at 13 miles an hour instead of 20 miles an hour until you develop this system. Then we can start to layer on some high intensity, some interval training, some weight training, and things that they're not in the black zone or in the black hole or the no man's land, because now you're above that level, but you're not spending, you know, a half an hour at it. You're spending minutes at a time, or sometimes 10 minutes at a time doing that. And by putting these component parts together, then when you get to that race or that event where you want to perform maximally, then you can race in that black hole heart rate zone, but now you're much better suited to do it and you're not just beating yourself up every day.
And is that something that definitely requires actual heart rate monitoring, or can you intuitively know if you're in this zone?
It pretty much requires heart rate monitoring until you get intuitive about it. So you have to sort of know through experience where that zone is and what it feels like. I mean, I can tell you that you can be in that zone, at least at the lowest end of the zone, as long as you can carry on a conversation without gasping with somebody that you're running with or cycling with, then you're in that zone. Once you have to gasp and start to catch up before you talk, you're out of that zone.
Okay, so now my big question, it's a little bit more of an epistemological question, but we keep talking about how hunter-gatherers lived and how that can inform in part our decisions that we make today. If reproduction was the end goal of hunter-gatherers and arguably their life wasn't set up for longevity, how do we know what to be informed about with our choices today if it wasn't set up for longevity anyways, their lifestyle?
No, it's a great question, really a great question. And you know, I don't have the answer other than many of our hunter-gatherer ancestors, if they survived the regular onslaught from a marauding tribe, you know, a warring tribe, hunting animals that were hunting them, poisonous plants, literally stepping on some sharp object and getting an infection. The number of things that could kill somebody while they were still in great health was overwhelming. And so the average lifespan was, as they say, in the 30s or whatever. But if you survived all of that, there was a good chance you could live to 90 or 94. And so we do know that many of our ancestors were able to live, not many, but those who lived, who survived all of the other traumatic events and rigors, were able to live well into their 90s. That does inform us. That just suggests that we've removed all these other extraneous factors, all these animals that are going to, you know, kill us in the middle of the night, or, you know, we have antibiotics if we get an infection now. Theoretically, we don't have that many wars where we're being invaded by other tribes anymore. And all that does is leave lifestyle as the prime indicator of whether or not you do make it to those 90s. I would say that I'm the biggest proponent of our sole reason for being here is to pass the genetic material along to the next generation and to set that generation up for success. And so I'd say setting that generation up for success includes, it takes a village, aunts and uncles and grandparents. But yeah, I just feel like our DNA, the genetic recipe that we each have really does want us to be strong, lean, fit, happy, healthy, productive, loving, you know, over as long a period of time as possible. Now, is that Dave Asprey's 160 years or whatever? No. Ain't going there. But, you know, if you get me to 90 and I'm still mobile, I'm going to be a very happy camper.
Do you think that's actually a parallel to something else you talk about? You talk about how if a person makes it to 80 today, then their rate of...
Yeah, the likelihood of getting to 90 is pretty significant. Yeah.
So like back then with the hunter-gatherers, the cap that you had to make it to was, you know, not getting killed compared to today where you make it to 80. And I'm thinking that like chronic disease is probably that thing that you're passing. It's like if you made it to 80, then you probably don't have the things happening of chronic disease.
100%. If you make it to 80 in good health, then I don't know what the number is. You've got a 60 or 70% chance of making it to 90. You know, if you make it to 80 and you're just hanging on by a thread, we won't talk about that. But if you're 80 and in good health, then you can easily predict another good 10 years.
Yeah, that is so, so fascinating.
Hey, friends. Did you know there is an ancient botanical that modern research shows performs on a level comparable to metformin when it comes to supporting healthy blood sugar levels? And not only that, this compound also supports the gut microbiome, healthy cholesterol levels, and even stimulates the AMPK pathway in the body to support cellular cleanup and longevity. You might have heard about AMPK. We talk about it a lot in the context of fasting, which also stimulates it. I am talking about berberine. I take berberine every single day of my life, and I see massive differences on my CGM, my continuous glucose monitor, when I use it. I take it to support my fast and before meals to reduce blood sugar levels. It is a powerhouse of a compound. And like I said, people are prescribed the pharmaceutical metformin to control their blood sugar levels when they could be taking this completely natural compound that has been used for thousands of years in both ancient traditional Chinese medicine and Ayurvedic medicine. I wanted to make the best berberine on the market, so that's why I created Avalon X Berberine 500. We did so much testing to find the most potent, pure, and clean form available. There's no problematic fillers, no common allergens, just pure, vegan, lab-tested berberine extracted from traditional sources. Friends, I am not kidding the difference I see on my blood sugar levels with this berberine. We're talking no post-meal spikes when I eat all that fruit and lower fasting blood sugar levels. It also reduced my HbA1c and my cholesterol levels. You can get it at avalonx.us. And the coupon code IFPODCAST will get you 10% off. You can also get a one-time 20% off coupon code when you text AvalonX to 877-861-8318. That's AvalonX to 877-861-8318. And you can get a 15% off coupon code by signing up for email updates. For that, just go to avalonx.us/email list. Again, friends, this is one of the most powerful compounds you can add into your health and wellness routine. Healthy blood sugar control, even if you're not pre-diabetic or diabetic, is so important, and berberine helps support that. It is the ultimate compound for blood sugar control, cholesterol, your gut microbiome, and longevity. Get it at avalonx.us with the coupon code IFPODCAST.
Another big question about how do we know what we know? You talked about in your career as an endurance athlete and your diet that you were following, the high carb diet, how you had GI distress. You said that something about how it wasn't the diet suited to you. So I am so haunted by this question. I actually recently had Dr. B, who wrote Fiber Fueled, on the show. And we were talking about, like, he thinks that any GI distress from like a high plant intake is just an indicator of a damaged gut. And that's what that means. And you need to like learn how to eat those plants. How do we know? Like this question of like, if the vegan versus carnivore wars, are plants anti-nutrients or are they, you know, the best thing ever? How do we know? There's just so many opinions.
That's, look, if I were a lay person listening to this show or listening to any show where you had on various guests and they had diverse opinions, I would be pulling my hair out because how do you know? That's exactly right. How do you know? You should, I don't know if he's still around, this guy, Konstantin Monastirsky. Have you ever heard the name or read the book?
Did he write the
Fiber Menace?
We've emailed before. I tried to get him on the show, but he said he wasn't doing shows much anymore.
I mean, I read the book 12 or 15 years ago, and I thought this guy has it nailed. This is, you know, the counter argument to fiber being the great panacea for everything that ails us. And I mean, I think we went through the 80s and 90s with dietary fiber being hailed as the missing link in health. And so breakfast cereals had more dietary fiber and Metamucil started taking off and psyllium husk became the sort of go-to broom to sweep out your colon. And I would argue that is so miscast as any sort of panacea, that fiber is not that necessary. And I'll get into why I think that. And I've had this discussion with Paul Saladino and with Sean Baker, both of whom I respect very highly. You know, Saladino has, he spent time as a vegan and it wrecked his health. And now he's a carnivore. And yet he's even adapted his carnivore lifestyle to include fruit and honey, but to exclude vegetables. And he's proposing that vegetables are anti-nutrients that are antithetical to health. And we most of us would probably do better not eating vegetables at all. Or that fiber in and of itself has no real nutritional benefit other than to feed certain bacteria in our gut. It's certainly been proven, I think, that fiber isn't, and most people view fiber as, again, like this giant broom sweeping your gut clean and, you know, taking these massive poops. And a lot of vegans that I know would say, if you don't poop after every meal, you're unhealthy. Well, I mean, please. I mean, that's just crazy. So let's talk about poop for a second. Fecal matter is largely dead bacteria. It's bacterial turnover from your gut. You have upwards of 60 trillion, some might say 100 trillion bacteria in your gut. And many of them have a lifespan of a day or two or you know, three or four. And that bacterial turnover, we have to get rid of it. Those dead bacteria have to come out of our gut. So we would poop without fiber. And as you can obviously understand from reading some of the reports from the carnivore people, they're bragging about they're having the easiest, most well-formed poops of their lives, having turned to carnivore. So that sort of proves that you don't need fiber to have a well-formed stool. And yeah, you can have fiber. And so Saladino would say, in fact, that plants are emergency food, that we really, as an evolving species, we always went for the meat first, the animal flesh, the animal source of protein first, whether it was shellfish or fish, if you live near the ocean, whether it was eggs, newts, toads, snakes, frogs, birds, or whether it was, you know, larger megafauna, whatever it was, the preferred human food and the most nutritious and nutrient dense form of food comes as animal protein. And once you've satisfied that requirement, you don't really need some additional amount of nutrition from, again, Saladino would say, and I would agree, many of the things that we used to look at as phytonutrients, right? These plant-based nutrients are actually relatively benign, but still they're there, poison that the plant would put out to discourage an animal from eating it. And it's a reason that to humans, most plants taste bitter. I mean, broccoli and kale and cauliflower and asparagus and all leafy greens are quite bitter to the taste, which is why we want to put butter on them or salt or steam them or put dressing on them. And that's historically an indication that it's probably not good to eat. I mean, there's a reason now we know or we can predict why kids don't like vegetables, because they're probably not designed to eat vegetables. And so we force them to eat vegetables because they're supposed to be good for you, right? On the other hand, fruit tastes great to us. Fruit is sweet. Fruit wants to be eaten. Fruit needs to be eaten in order for it to carry on its genetic mandate of passing that genetic material along to the next generation. So in our true analysis of how we got here and how we evolved with a slight distaste for plant matter and an appreciation of fruit, and I don't care what community it is around the world, and you might say, well, some of these Blue Zones people, they don't eat that much meat. When you offer them more meat, they eat more meat because it's about access. It's not about preference, right? If they had access to more meat, they would prefer it. They would choose to eat it. So, gosh, that got off on all kinds of tangents there about poop and about, so the fiber part of this, back to the butyric acid and you know, food for the certain bacteria that reside in the gut. Certainly some forms of fiber act as a substrate for those gut bacteria to produce those butyrates and those short chain fatty acids. On the other hand, So does collagen. And ancestrally, most people ate nose to tail. They didn't just eat the T-bone, you know, or the prime rib or the ribeye. They ate the gristle and parts of the skin and the omentum and other parts of the animal that were high in collagenous, gelatinous material. And it was that material that acted as the substrate for those bacteria in the gut to create those short chain fatty acids and feed the cells lining the gut. Ergo, you get hundreds of thousands of people now who are on the carnivore diet who are claiming all of their dietary woes are gone. Like they're cured. And I would suggest that's the explanation. There are a lot of people who try to eat vegetables, try to eat more fiber. I mean, if fiber is your problem, then the worst thing you can do is listen to somebody's advice that says, well, yes, fiber is your problem. You're not eating enough of it, right? So, I mean, Monastirsky had this great thing of this theory that much of the fiber from grains, which, you know, the bran from grains, which was initially, again, sold as a benefit to health, starting back from the days of Kellogg and then throughout all of the breakfast cereal manufacturers, and then a little heart healthy emblem that it would that somehow that fiber would sop up all the bad cholesterol in you. I mean, Monastirsky said, look, when that fiber hits your gut, it expands. And your colon, your intestines and your colon they're smooth muscle. They're not striated muscle. They're not designed to expand. And if you expand them, that's how you develop diverticuli and diverticulitis. And that's how you get, you know, gut problems and you get additional permeability. So I'm having not just read more over the past decades, but having followed and talked to Paul Saladino and Sean Baker, my own diet is becoming more carnivore and less plant-based. You know, one of my original claims to fame was I was the proponent of the big ass salad. Do you remember back that far?
I remember. Oh, I was there.
Yeah. So I was the big ass salad guy. I don't eat a big ass salad ever anymore. And I'm not suggesting that people don't. It's just that for me, I'm like, okay, I'm like, part of this is also back to my two meals a day strategy, which was the recognition that even I, as buff and cut as I am at my age, was eating too much food. Like, I don't need to eat as much food as I even thought I needed 10 years ago, you know, or even 5 years ago. So one of the ways to cut down on the amount of food is to cut kind of the bulk out first and go, okay, I'm going to start with protein. I got to get, you know, I know I got to get my protein requirements in every day, and then add in some fat. Great. Okay. I got some fat. And then I'm not a big fan of carbs, but if I do, it'll be fruit and a little bit of vegetables. But I really don't eat salads much anymore. It's not like I don't like them. I love the crunchiness. I love the feeling. I love the, you know, if you dress them to the hilt, then you can't even know that there's lettuce in there. That's why I created Primal Kitchen, so I could have salad dressings that I can slather onto my salads, right? And not just have to use them sparingly, but make the salad dressing the primary taste element in that otherwise fairly bitter concoction.
For listeners, I've had both Paul and John Baker on the show, so I'll put links to that in the show notes. Here's a question that haunts me about all of this, though, and I think about this all the time. And it's that in the nose-to-tail argument, I don't understand if organ meats are so nutritious, especially something like liver. I don't know why people, especially even people like in the paleo world and people who have, quote, cleaned up their diet, why people don't seem to like liver. And like, even for me, I went through a period of time where I was very anemic and I was like, okay, like I never had like liver. So I was like, I'm sure I'm going to love the way this tastes because I'm anemic. Like, this is something that would nourish my body. And I just couldn't stomach it. And I don't know if that's a learned response, or if there's something in these organ meats that we shouldn't be eating.
Well, I don't think it's something that we shouldn't be eating. I do think it's a learned response. I think, you know, we have refined our taste buds for better or worse over the years to seek out more sweet, you know, crunchy, salty, fatty, sweet. It's just a artifact of the food production and manufacturing environment. And so we've lost, some of us have lost that taste for savory. I mean, I'm about ready to head over to Europe. When I'm in France, I will have foie gras every single day. It's like one of my favorite foods in the world. And it'll be in the form of pate or just a regular liver. But, you know, it's cooked a certain way. And I do remember when I was, I'm going to say 12, 13 years old, I started cooking chicken livers for myself, chicken livers and onions. And I loved it.
I just wonder if like vitamin toxicity might be a thing.
I'm not going to, I would highly doubt that if that's the issue. If that's, you know, there is a body of work that suggests that if your body, if it doesn't taste good to you, don't eat it. Your body's not craving it. And we had some friends back in Malibu about 15 years ago. They lived in a van down by the river. They were brilliant. They were a European couple, and they wrote a book called Gene Fit Nutrition, G-E-N-E, Fit Nutrition. And their thesis was that you craved the things that you craved for reasons that had to do with deficiencies. And so they had a program, and they would come to our house. We hosted this program, and there were like 15 people signed up. And they would come for lunch and dinner every day, and our people would come to our house. And this couple would set out all these foods on the table. And it would be, and they're all raw, by the way, and it would be raw liver, raw vegetables, fruit, raw, I remember they were like crab, raw basketball crab, like an actual full-on 10-inch body shell basketball crab. Fish still in the, still in the skin, just like you'd see at a, like you'd pick a fish out at a restaurant. And they would blindfold you and hold these different foods up to your nose, and you would pick what you're going to have for lunch. And it was bizarre that what people would pick, and then they'd have to eat it, and they'd have to eat it raw. They wound up leaving Malibu to go buy an island and set up a retreat somewhere. But it was a really interesting, concept. Whether or not it was legit, I don't know. So I do think that so much of our current taste patterns are artificially engineered by, the foods that we grew up on that may have not have been quite appropriate for us.
Hi, friends. Guess what? Have you ever wanted a dating app that takes into account your dietary preferences? Things like fasting, whether or not you're paleo, keto, vegan, omnivore, junk food lover, whatever it may be. Or maybe it's important to you that you date a fellow wine drinker or a coffee lover, or you're sober curious and don't want drinks to be the first date. Speaking of first dates, did you know that the top four first dates all involve food or drink? That's right. Food and drink are super important for compatibility. That's why I'm making a dating app to address this. It's basically like any other mainstream dating app, except you can filter by dietary preference. For all of the launch information, including how to get it and launch specials, get on the email list. For that, go to cravingdating.com. Again, that's cravingdating.com. Through that list, we'll be sending updates, information about the launch, and even let you guys weigh in on the development. So again, go now to cravingdating.com.
Yeah, there's a really fascinating study that I can put in the show notes, and it's an old study. They couldn't do it today because of probably ethical reasons, but they basically let babies up until a certain age self-select their meals, and it was all of these foods. The entirety of the foods would cover all of their nutritional basis if they selected the right combinations, but it was things like liver and egg yolks, and the babies would intuitively just eat what they needed from everything. So it's pretty interesting. I'm glad you brought up the Primal Kitchen stuff because I'm dying to just quickly pick your brain on some of that experience and in your life as an entrepreneur. Super curious with the Primal Kitchen stuff, goal-wise, it was acquired by Heinz?
Kraft Heinz.
So when you first started it, did you have goals like that? Was that not a goal? Like, did you, because like right now, for example, this is not even remotely the same thing, but I created an app that's doing really well and people have wanted to buy it. And I'm like, but then it's attached to my name. Like, what if it changes and then people associate it with me still? So I'm super curious just about your journey, what that's been like. And congratulations as well.
Oh, thanks. Thanks. It's been three and a half years since I sold it. It's been a long time already. But no, I always built it with the intent on exiting, on selling it. I mean, I was 61 years old when I started the company. So I was already, you know, like long in the tooth and didn't want to, you know, build something that was going to be with me for 15 or 20 years. I also recognize that the nature of the food industry is that if you prove the concept and you build it right, there's a point at which you run out of money and you either have to do an IPO or do another raise. But in order to get what I wanted was my mission was to change the way the world eats. And that started with Mark's Daily Apple back in 2006. It continued with all of my books, which were all geared toward educating and changing the way the world eats. It continued with the Primal Kitchen restaurants, which were unfortunately not sustainable. And it continued with the recognition that when you clean up your diet, when you get rid of the industrial seed oils and the sugars and the added sugars and sweeteners and things like that, and you get rid of the processed foods and processed grains, you come down to a fairly short list of things that are appropriate for every person. Meat, fish, fowl, eggs, nuts, seeds, vegetables, a little bit of fruit, maybe some starchy tubers. That's not a big list, but there are literally millions of ways to prepare these based on the herbs, the spices, methods of preparation, methods of cooking, sauces, dressings, toppings. I started with a book in 2010 called Primal Blueprint Sauces, Dressings, and Toppings. I had had massive success with my first book, The Primal Blueprint, and I thought this was going to crush. So we printed 40,000 copies. I think we sold 8,000 copies so far. So what I got from that was that people want sauces and dressings and toppings. They just don't want to make them. They don't want to read about them and make them themselves. And so that was the impetus for Primal Kitchen. And what that did was it made me rethink how food is prepared at an industrial level in this country and how it's offered up. The first big, I think, aha moment and proof of concept was to introduce a jar of mayonnaise, a 12-ounce jar of mayonnaise that cost $9.95. Cost almost three times as much as most mayonnaise that size. And to realize that there were millions of people who were like, oh my God, finally someone gets me. Someone understands that I pay attention to the ingredient panel. And this is, I'm willing and I'm able to pay that amount of money for a demonstrably better product. In fact, our sort of internal corporate mantra is, whatever category we enter, we want to be demonstrably the best product in that category. That means not having offensive ingredients. That means having certain ingredients that are known to be, I won't use the term superfood, but, you know, defined as better for you, like avocado oil, for instance. And probably the most important criteria, it has to taste good, right? If it doesn't taste good, it doesn't matter what's in it. And that was the reason for this. Well, with Primal Kitchen, if my mission was to change the way the world eats, I need it to be a billion-dollar company. And as many startups encounter, you hit a point where your original management team, the scale of manufacturing, whatever it is, can't keep up with your intent for growth. And so I knew fairly early on, like 3 years in, I was ready to start to go to market and find a buyer. We'd certainly proven that we were the new golden child in the food industry. We were the new kids on the block, but everybody knew who we were in the food industry. And I needed a partner, if you will, who could express my plan and execute on my plan to change the way the world eats. Now, if that included engendering other competitive products that were just as good, so be it. That's part of my plan, was to change the way the world eats. And if I were able to do it that way, both through the expansion and the resources that Kraft Heinz gave us, and it was an amazing choice. I mean, I could not have picked a better partner. They basically kept our entire team. They didn't fire anybody. They gave us financial resources to grow even faster. They've sat back and literally watched us and said, "Holy crap, like we're extremely pleased with this company and with this acquisition, and we want to learn from this because we have, you know, 40 other brands that some of which need a little bit of work." And so it has fulfilled pretty much all my expectations. We're not at $1 billion yet, but I have no doubt we'll get there.
Yeah, I'm so, so interested in this because I recently launched a supplement line. So I'm like right at the very beginning, but same thing with your mission of making like the best that you can of a certain product and then having to evaluate the price point for that and everything. It's just been such a learning experience. So you're actively still involved?
Yes. Oh, sure. Yep. I mean, I sold it. They own 100% of the company, but I'm still, you know, the face of the brand and the spokesperson, and I'm involved in decisions and you know, R&D. Yeah.
Gotcha. And then the ill-fated restaurant. You said in one of your books, I think you said there was like 7 times that you knew that you probably should have quit with it. I'm wondering what you've learned about that whole experience with when to quit and should we quit and why?
No, that's you know, another sort of, I can only give you opinions on that, but ultimately all of those decisions come down to your gut. In this case, my gut was that while it was a great idea and people liked they loved the restaurant. I mean, when we opened, people said, "Oh my God, it's about time somebody gave this a run."
Yeah, I loved it, by the way. It was fabulous. I was so sad when I went back. I was like, "What happened?"
Yeah. Well, you have no idea how sad I was, but we had plenty of business. We had, you know, we had great reviews, and we were losing $40,000 a month at that one location. And by the way, we had another location in Indianapolis that a franchisee had bought that was having similar problems. And we realized that, and I, not to cast too much blame, but I had a partner who was the restaurant guy. I was the brand guy. I mean, we sold 18 franchises without an operating unit. It was one of the most successful franchises in the history of franchising. But my partner was an operations guy, and he just literally didn't do the math, and there was no way to fix these losses. And you know, when you're losing $40,000 a month on a restaurant, you can look at it as, well, if we really fix things up and tidy up here and clean it up there and do this and do that, maybe we can get to break even in a year. Well, you know, in a year, that's another $240,000 down the drain. That's 6 BMWs. Sorry, that's what am I saying? It's almost $500,000 down the drain. I was thinking 6 months. And who wants to be at break even? You know, I want to make a profit. I don't want to just work my ass off to get to break even. So we literally had to pull the plug in order not to spend millions more on what probably, based on food costs, and in LA, it's, you know, the regulations and the wages and the rent and everything made it almost impossible for it to be a successful going concern. So yeah, I had to pull a plug, and it was very painful, but it had to be done.
I mean, I think it's something, because people obviously experience successes and failures in life. So is it something, looking back, that you, like, would you have done things differently? Would you have started it not from that initial, you know, calculation error with the math, or was that the way it was supposed to happen? And
oh, you can only look at these things as that's how it had to happen. I named it Primal Kitchen Restaurants, right? And I started the restaurant at the same time I started the food company. And I thought they'd be synergistic. Well, then when I realized the food company was taking off and the restaurant was going to be dragging things down, I realized that was a mistake to name them both the same name. So in addition to the other factors, I also didn't want the losses accumulating on the restaurant side to taint the brand that was Primal Kitchen on the food side. But I learned for the second time in my life, I learned that I shouldn't be in the restaurant business.
For the second time?
Oh, I had a restaurant in 1983 for about a year that, again, it was ahead of its time. It was like, it was frozen yogurt and a 60-foot long salad bar and healthy brand muffins, which were the thing back in the day. And, you know, and it was really, again, very well received, but just suffered from a bad location. Oh, also suffered from the fact that we had a bank loan in 1983 at 17.75%. So for anybody who's old enough to remember the 80s, and we're hearing about it, you know, you hear about inflation now, hasn't been this bad for almost 40 years. Well, that was what we were dealing with, was a bank loan at 17.75%, which we felt privileged to be able to get, by the way. So we couldn't, you know, it was another financial consideration. And I should have learned my lesson then, because I had a partner in that too, and I don't do well with partners. So there were a number of lessons, but all of these things, like everything I've done in my life, points to where I am today, and I wouldn't go back and change any of it. Even the painful stuff, like the years I spent bent over in pain because of IBS that literally ran my life every single day. I wouldn't have come to the Primal Blueprint and my stance on grains and gluten had it not been for that horrible physical experience that I had, you know? So, you know, people say, well, if you could go back and you knew how to train like you do now, if you could train, you know, for triathlon in a way that incorporates and embodies all of the things you talk about today, would you do it? I'm like, no, because, you know, it hurt too much. And I only learned what I know today because of the mistakes I made then. So to any entrepreneur, I would say, look, you only need one home run in your entire career, right? And you could have a ton of failures. And one home run, even a triple, makes it worth all of that stuff that you tried and failed at.
Another super random fast question. So you talk about the importance of social community and relationships in your books. So obviously you don't have to name names, but I'm super curious because you talk about how they say that the five people that you surround yourself with are 90-something percent responsible for your success. So who are the five people that you historically have surrounded yourself with? Like what types of people?
Yeah, outside of my wife and my kids, I have not had a really close alignment, but I would say, you know, one of my friends who's one of the largest vitamin sellers in the world and my best friend and godfather to my kids, I hang around him a lot. I don't know if you know Tony Horton. Tony and I, and this other guy, by this third guy, just the guy I just mentioned, the three of us were single and didn't have a pot to piss in, living in Santa Monica in the mid 80s. And each one of us became like quite successful in our own right. I would almost say very extremely successful in our own right. And so, you know, we kind of lifted each other up in that regard and supported each other. So it wasn't just about, and then I've got another friend who, you know, is a trust fund guy, but always a great attitude. And even though he was a trust fund guy, he had to be in business all the time. He had to start his own stuff because he needed to feel, you know, like he was, you know, producing or contributing, right? And that's, you know, that's kind of my core group. And then, you know, I've got new friends now where I live in Miami. And much of what I've done over my career is to weed out the negative influences more than to find positive influences. And when you say you're the average of the five people you hang around with most, I've weeded out a lot of bad energy in my life. But people who I thought were my friends or thought were contributing to my own greater good, but ultimately weren't. And I think that's a real particular skill to be able to say no to somebody and say, you know, I'm sorry, we just resonate on different wavelengths and it's not you or it's not me. It's just, this isn't going to work.
Well, this has been so amazing. I so appreciate your time. We didn't even get into, before we started recording, you were talking about how you are known as like the anti-biohacking. But I will say, so I feel like I'm sort of anti-biohacking in that, like, I think the goal of biohacking is to create things in our life that would put our bodies in a state that would have been the way we were without modern technology. So it's like reverting back. It's like using cryotherapy to get cold exposure. So it's not to like...
No, but I mean, that's exactly my point. My point would be that biohackers, for the most part, don't want to do the work. They want the shortcut, right? They don't want to feel the pain or do the work. So the cryotherapy, you know, I was in 320 below, you know, air for, you know, 2 minutes and it was awesome, dude. And then, well, no, get in a 46 degree cold plunge for 4 minutes and then tell me how you feel, right? Or I've got a bike that wear these compression sleeves around your thighs and they pump cold water through it and 10 minutes is worth an hour and a half on the bike. I'm like, no, it's not. Get out and ride the bike for an hour and a half and then tell me, you know, how you feel. I think, you know, I've got a watch that tells me how I slept last night. Seriously? Like, how'd you sleep last night? Oh, I feel pretty good. I don't know. I don't need a device to tell me how I feel.
Yeah. Well, the last question that I ask every single guest on this show, and it's just because I realize more and more each day how important mindset is. So what is something that you're grateful for?
I am grateful for my family. I've got a wonderful family. I've got a wife of 32 years. We've been together 34. Two amazing kids and now two grandchildren as a result of that. So I am extremely grateful for my family.
Well, thank you so much, Mark. I am so grateful for your work. Like I said, I've been following you for so long and you are truly, I mean, you're talking about that goal of changing the way the world eats. You are truly changing so many lives. And this has been such an honor and such a dream. So thank you for your time and happy travels.
Thank you, Melanie. It's been a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you, Mark. Bye.
Thank you so much for listening to the Melanie Avalon Biohacking Podcast. For more information, you can check out my book, What When Wine, Lose Weight and Feel Great with Paleo Style Meals, Intermittent Fasting, and Wine, as well as my blog, melanieavalon.com. Feel free to contact me at podcast@melanieavalon.com. And always remember, you got this.